Good morning. This is going to be something of a Superman moment here in a few minutes at 9:30 because I have to get out of this uniform and get into my whites. And that's because of the fact that we live in an extremely politically correct world. And those of us who are in the military who speak are very, very cautious of what we say in uniform. So I would ask you, when you ask questions, if I'm in this uniform, it's a free-for-all. If I'm in my whites or my military uniform, please be discreet in your question because I don't know who's going to be around us. There are people who ask questions and they do so deliberately. And I'm not accusing any of you of this. But many of my chaplain friends and military friends have been caught in precarious situations under this particular administration. And it is something that we're very, very conscious of as military members because we respect our nation. We respect the leadership. We respect the positions far more than we respect the individuals who sit in many of those seats today. After 9/11, I was in D.C., and Pastor John Vaughn, who many of you know, shortly thereafter asked me to start to think about speaking about what I was learning in the Pentagon subsequent to 9/11. And that immediately created a huge knot in my gut and in my throat because I was going to say, you've got to be kidding me. I don't want to speak about this. And he said, you must. Well, I settled on a verse and then settled on something that connects all of what I do in this context together. Be Still Ministries comes from Psalm 46. Be still and know that I am God. And when you talk about this and you understand where we are today, we must as believers be still and recognize that there is a sovereign God in heaven who's not taken surprise by any of this. He knew it long before any of us were born, any of us were thought about. And we have to trust him and his perfect wisdom in the midst of that. So what I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to do what I would call an Islam 101. Tonight I'm going to talk about the end times, and in the morning service I'll just talk about some things with reference to our American history. So as you talk about Islam, the dilemma that you face is that you are hearing almost nothing that is doctrinally and legally correct as prescribed and stated by Islam itself. Most everything that you hear in the press, most everything you hear from many ostensibly religious leaders is fundamentally incorrect, and I'll use a word that must be understood in the context, doctrinally incorrect according to the doctrine of Islam. They are a doctrinal and a legal or a juridic civilization, and this definition is extremely important as you try to sort this out. Islam is a comprehensive system of thought and life, a replacement civilization. They've been replacing civilization since 600. It's a distinct legal system, and this last phrase is probably the most important, within which is a religion. Islam is not first and foremost a religion. And that's extremely important. They know what we understand in terms of the First Amendment. Islam does not derive First Amendment coverage or protection because it's a legal system. Therefore, you have to go to Article 6. And when you want to bring Islam into the United States, that's sedition and treason issues because they want to replace U.S. law, the entire U.S. Constitution, with the Sharia. That is the history of Islam in a nutshell. And so when we listen to what's going on in the press, this is the lens through which you must listen, understand, and hear what's going on. So as I take a look at this, and as I work through the process in the Pentagon, beginning with the 17th of September, I had to figure out what to read. And so as you look at all the literature that's out there, the only works that I deal with, I shouldn't say this, the only, but for the overwhelming majority, the only books that I read are works that were written by Muslims for Muslims. That's the only place that you get true truth. There are these other categories, that which is written by Muslims for non-Muslims, that's deliberate propaganda material. Non-Muslims for non-Muslims, this is basically, I'll call it, your Islam for idiots materials, and then written by former Muslims, by non-Muslims. This is very dangerous territory. I have a friend who's been a missionary in Albania for some 20 years, and his comment as he's dealt with Muslims for this whole period of time is that I don't trust a Muslim who's converted to Christianity for at least 10 years. Because lying and deception is an inherent aspect of Islam. They have a Muslims have a moral, legal obligation to lie to non-Muslims. That's embedded in the whole system of Islam. So when you're listening to Muslims speak, you should all automatically assume I'm probably not being told the truth. Now that's a difficult thing for us as believers, as Americans, to comprehend and to understand, because for us, truth is fundamental. We assume truthfulness. Well, unfortunately, Islam is not built on the same logic structure, truth structure that we are built on, that the West in general is built on, right? So current events, okay, if you ask the question, and unfortunately the slides are slid up, but so I'll look at here. The rest of the question is, what is the relationship between the following attacks? 9/11, Paris, Istanbul recently, and Bangladesh. Every single one of these attacks has a relationship to history with reference to Islam. And the Muslims have phenomenal memories, and they understand their history, and they understand a very, very important aspect of what Islam is. Islam is all about the control of territory. And when territory, whether it's a country or a nation or a county or a city, comes under the control of Islam, that is to say, you have Islamic leadership and you have Islamic law, that becomes the land of Allah. So for a Muslim, if Muslims have captured land and then they have lost the land, that's an embarrassment to Allah. And all Muslims know that if they've embarrassed Allah, stand by to stand by, because Allah is not a very gracious God. He does not take this lightly. And in their minds, this is very serious. So every single one of these events that we've experienced in recent history are a function of Islamic history, all right? So when you take a look at, this is Islamic conquest. And in what we see as Saudi Arabia, that which is conquered in the first 11 years of Muhammad's reign. The next section, which includes most of the Middle East, that was conquered between 11 and 40 AH. AH equals after Hajj. The calendar in Islam begins with the migration of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. Basically, that's year one. And there was no history from a Muslim's perspective before that date. Now, that's sort of bizarre, but we have to walk in their shoes and how they think about things. And then by the time you get to about 130 years later, you can see in that yellow area the extent of Islamic territory. So you're all the way out here. Notice this is Spain. Here you're going up through Turkey. But later on, you're going to see how it came across the Dardanelles and went up into Europe. And that's extremely important for us as we think about these things, all right? So there are some battles. 732, Charles Martel, basically, and this was in France, basically pushed the Muslims back across the Pyrenees, and they never really had control of any land north of the Pyrenees. But Muslims remember the fact that the French pushed back the Muslims. They defeated Islam in their country. Therefore, Paris. The Battle of Granada, 1492. While Columbus was sailing west, the king and the queen were just romping on the Muslims that were all over Spain and kicking them back across the Gibraltar and regaining the land for Catholicism. Now, there's not been a battle there yet. There's not been a major event in Spain yet, but I'm expecting it to take place. Then in 1529, there was the Siege of Vienna, and later there was the Battle of Vienna in 1683. Those are very, very important dates and locations. The Battle of Lepanto in 1571 was a naval battle. It's one of the most significant naval battles in all of human history. And basically, the entire Ottoman Empire navy was sunk in the Mediterranean. And the Muslims have not forgotten about that, right? Now, this is where we see the empire moving. You can see where it's moving up into Hungary, Budapest, etc., and that's by 1580. Now, this is the significant one, the Battle of Vienna. Note the dates. September 11th and 12th, 1683, September 11th in the mind of Muslims is a day of infamy as it relates to Islam. Because basically the European leadership, all the countries of Europe, basically joined together under the Polish king and generals, and they basically slaughtered the Islamic army and basically stripped them essentially naked and sent them marching back to Constantinople. That's the biggest and most significant defeat of the Islamic army anywhere in Islamic history. So September 11th for them, anytime they can do something on behalf of Islam on September 11th, that's a major kudo for them. Therefore, September 11th was a major date in the United States because it was a significant, and they were going against a significant enemy of Islam. Now, there are battle rules in Islam. A Muslim cannot go to war against a non-Muslim just arbitrarily. So here is actually what happened prior to 9/11 over the course of the period of time that President Bush had been our president. Several times, three times specifically, he received letters and direct invitations to bring the United States under the authority of Islam. He generally speaking ignored them, did not respond to them, and the Muslims gave him time to respond. The fact that President Bush three times said no thank you as it relates to Islam in terms of America and American history gave the Islamic world the authority to engage in a defensive act against the United States. Now, I'm using words deliberately. It was a defensive act. They were not on the offense against the United States as they understood it. The reason why it was defensive was because we, as America and Americans, had basically rejected Allah. So we had offended Allah. Therefore, because we had offended Allah, and that was an offensive act, all Muslims then had the authority, according to Islamic law, to attack us. So what bin Laden did was actually a legitimate, legal warfare decision on behalf of Islam. That's how things work in Islam. September 11th is the date because that was their major enemy, and America today is the major enemy of Islam. And they have a whole approach for this. Now, this just gives you a map and an idea of just how far that they had gone, and then they kept getting kicked back. And then by the time we get to 1914, whoops, Pastor Phelps is teaching you how to wear an earring. And I'm learning that. So this is where Islam was in 1914. 1914 is important because it was in the area, the time frame after World War I that the Ottoman Empire was dissolved. And I don't have time to go into all the history there, but this is a huge embarrassment to Islam and to Muslims in general. This is, if you will, the history of what was going on. So let's talk about some terms. It's a system. So a system has terms and terminology. Islam literally means submission to Allah or a slave of Allah. A Muslim is the person. So Islam is the system or the civilization. A Muslim is the person. And so when you're using the terms, be careful with how you use them. And both of them are transliterations essentially from the Arabic. They are basically coming from the same word stem in the Arabic. Ummah is the whole worldwide community of Muslims. And Muslims have an allegiance to only one entity. It is to Islam itself. They have allegiance to no one else, to nothing else, because the only sovereign in the world, according to Islam, is Allah himself. He holds all sovereign control over everything. That's important because as we talk about things in the West, we talk about the sovereignty of nations, right? We talk about I pledge allegiance to the flag, etc., to the republic. Well, no Muslim can do that because the only allegiance that they can have is to Allah himself. Well, that has huge significance in terms of what does it mean for a Muslim to be an American. We can come back to that. The caliph is the leader of the Islamic Ummah, or the worldwide. And then we have the Quran, which is the final divine guidance. And believe me, they talk about final divine very, very specifically, because our Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, all the other books that they recognize as coming from God are altered, incorrect, and therefore the Quran is the final guidance from God. The Sirah is the biography of Muhammad. And we in Christianity don't have anything that's a direct corollary to this. The closest would be the Gospels, which we could call the biography of Jesus, but that's not a completely correct correlation. But the biography of Muhammad is extremely important because that's where Muslims go to gain most of their information about how to lead life as a Muslim, because the perfect example in Islam is Muhammad himself. So that which he said, that's what he did, is the perfect example, that which they should follow. And the hadith, this is a monstrous record of the words and deeds of Muhammad. Now, this is all important because if you're talking to a Muslim, this is where things are coming from. This is what guides their lives. And together, the Sirah and the hadith are known as the Sunnah. Now, the Islamic fundamentals, or what we would call the corpus juris of Islamic law, comes in these packages. And so we have the Quran itself, we have the commentary on the Quran, and believe me, commentaries on the Quran are not as easily written or frequently written as they are in Christianity. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of commentaries on any particular book in the Bible. Well, believe me, that does not happen in Islam, because that's very, very carefully managed by the religious leadership, the doctrinal legal scholars within Islam. And the tafsir, and the one by Ibn Kathir, is the top dog in that hierarchy. Then we have, again, the Sirah Rusal Allah, which are the habits and practices of Muhammad, or the biography of Muhammad. This becomes important down to very simple things. And when we talk about Islam, it's an exceptionally legalistically driven construct. It gets to things such as simple as, which sandal do you put on first? What is legal and what is not legal for a Muslim? And over the course of history, what the legal scholars have had to do is to write permissions for Muslims to do things. So let's take yourself back to 600 AD for a second. And this is just a single illustration. What do you think the primary means of transportation, the two primary means of transportation would have been for Muhammad? Donkey, camel, and foot. All right? So, did Muhammad drive a car? Did he ride a train? No. They actually have written fatwas when those technologies were developed to permit Muslims to drive cars, to ride on trains, to go on boats, etc. Same thing for computers, and the list goes on and on. They are that legalistically driven, and they do not do things that have not been permitted either directly from Muhammad himself or by the legal scholars in terms of what Muslims are permitted to do, permitted and allowed to do. And then we have Sharia jurisprudence, which is the law of all Islamic lands, and that covers every Muslim in every land, regardless of whether or not it's a Muslim-majority country. So the primary legal system to which all Muslims who live in the United States adhere is the Sharia. It's not to the U.S. Constitution. It's not to the Indiana Constitution. It's not to the local laws. It's to the Sharia itself. Then they have Sharia policy. This is government according to the objectives of Sharia. So we have government policy. What government policy derives from in Islam is from the Islamic jurisprudence, the Sharia jurisprudence. So that tells them how they should. It includes such things as, can a husband beat his wife? And in Islam, you betcha, right? In fact, one of the pieces of guidance for men is to whip your wife into submission, literally, all right? So I could go on and on, and your eyeballs would probably be falling out of your heads when you begin to realize just exactly how male-centric and anti-female Islam actually is, and the same thing can be said for children on many levels. So when we take a look at the Quran, the periods of Quranic revelation occur in basically four periods. These are four periods in the life of Muhammad. Early when he was in Mecca, there were very, very few people who actually accepted Islam. And so it was very meek what he received from Allah. Now, this is the percentage of the Quran that was received by Muhammad when he was in Mecca early and then later, and then the later portion, and then when he goes to Medina. And the 48 or the 21 or the 21, that's the number of chapters in the Quran that are affiliated with this period of time. And what's important here is the nature of the language of the chapters that were revealed in each of those four sections. Now, when we talk about Islam, the reason why the Medinan section is red is because all of the bloody chapters in the Quran were revealed to him when he was in Medina, when he was actually ready to become the warrior king of Islam and basically to go back and to take Mecca by the sword. I could spend more time on that, but I won't, just because there's just so much to say. So when we take a look at all of what they have, all of their literature, the composite, what you find is that it's broken down into these three sections. But when you actually break it out and you ask, what's the subject? What's the subject of each of these books, this trilogy of text? Well, Islam is, that is, and this is Islam. This is what we would call the Islamic Bible. It's 14% about Allah and 80% about Muhammad. All right? So the focal point of all of Islam is Muhammad, not Allah. There's not a lot written in the Quran in particular that gives us a theology proper of Allah. And the theology proper of Allah is vastly different than the theology proper of Jehovah, the Lord God of Judeo-Christianity. When we talk about another way of dividing it, it's basically the amount of text that's devoted to the kafir. The kafir, in terms of human population, is all of the human beings that are existing or have ever existed who did not accept Islam. Were the infidels, were the unbelievers. Now, what's important here is that when you take a look at the material written, given to Muslims, right? The Quran is two-thirds about how does a Muslim address and relate to a non-Muslim. The biography of Muhammad is 81%. The hadith is 37%. So basically a third, two-thirds of everything that was given to Muslims in terms of how to live their lives is about how do they treat non-Muslims. Now, think about that for a second. How much of our Bible relates to how do we treat non-Christians or non-Jews? There's some, yes, but it's certainly not the majority as it is. And this is extremely important because it's down to very, very small detail things as to how do you deal with the booty that you conquered or that you take and you distribute once you've conquered a non-Muslim community. So as we take a look at Islam kind of from a sect perspective, you've got Sunni, Shia, Sufi, Salafi, and the percentages are important, but all you should do with these is allow them to be informational, because whether a Muslim's a Sunni or a Shia or a Sufi or of a Salafi, to us doesn't matter. That's the internal fight, the internal discussion within Islam. You don't get into an interfamily fight, right? When the Muslims turn their face to the rest of the world, they are unified. It's only when they're fighting across borders like Iran and Iraq, which are artificial boundaries, do we ever see any issues. And that's the time for us to stand back, let the Muslims fight it out among themselves. And so this is just informational, so you understand how did they get there, what are the differences, etc. But do not allow yourself to get caught into a discussion of the differences between Sunni law and Shia law, because at the end of the day, they are 95% in agreement over the course of the history of all Islamic law. There's not differences of opinion. Islamic law is written very carefully, and they don't dispute with each other because they know that that's not what Allah would want them to do. So we have these schools of law, And I just give these to you so that you have an idea that, yes, there are schools of law, and they go from the more benign to the far more rigorous in terms of their nature. Here's another way of displaying this, and this is the Sunni side, because this is where the majority of it is. And if you notice in that red section, this relates very closely to the red section in terms of the Quran. But you have the Wahhabi, the Takfir, and the Hanbali. And that's all very important. But if you go out to where it says the Hanafi, whenever I talk about Islamic law, I go to the most benign, the least offensive, the least poke it in your eye kind of stuff, material. Because if I can prove a point as it relates to Islam from the Hanafi version of the Islamic law, that's where I want to go. Because then I can't be accused of going after the Wahhabis or the Tafsir or the Hanbalis. And when you do that, the Muslims go, uh-oh, we're in trouble, because this is the most gentle of all of us, and the most gentle of all of our scholars say these same things. And so when you walk through Islam from this perspective, you begin to realize just exactly what you're up against. And most Muslims go, uh-oh. And if you, okay, I'm going to just kind of take a little bit of a backwards turn here for a second. When you read your Bibles, how is our Bible compiled, generally speaking? Chapter and verse, but how are the books compiled, put together in terms of a table of contents? Time, right? Genesis is the beginning and Revelation is at the end, right? And all the books in between are basically, it's a chronological record of God's revelation to us. And so it's very easy to read, correct? Now, we have some places when you get into Kings and Chronicles that you have to interweave some things and so forth and so on. And even when we have the book of Acts, and then we take a look at how does that relate to the Pauline epistles, but it's generally fairly simple. So that's how our Bible is compiled. Now, let me give you the alternative option. In Islam, instead of that kind of a historical chronological order to things, they compile the Quran based on the length of the chapter. And it goes from longest to shortest, or shortest to longest, depending on which one of the... So let's ask this question. What's the longest chapter in the Bible? Psalm 119. Right? So that would be the first chapter in our Bible if we compile it. What's the shortest chapter in the Bible? 117, right? So if you had 119 and 117 and you put all the rest of the chapters of the Bible in chronological or in length order, and you attempted to read that, how long would it take you to get to the point before you were scratching your head and going, I have no idea what's going on here? Well, that's the case when you and most Muslims don't understand that chronology, and they don't even want to get into the debate of that. So most Muslims, therefore, do not read their Quran because they don't want to make a mistake in terms of chronological context. And therefore, most Muslims are going to defer to their Islamic leaders, and basically they're going to back out of the discussion because of that. We, on the other hand, are basically commanded and encouraged to read it because it does make sense. You have to wonder how come that happened. I don't have an answer to that question. But so when they talk about it, and this gives you an idea of the legal structure of it. You have the Sharia, which is derived from the Quran, the fiqh, which is the legal understandings, the fatwas with the opinions, the ijma, which is the consensus of the scholars, the ijtihad with the process of legal reasoning, and dawah, which is the inviting of the unbelievers to Islam. And believe me, dawah is an extremely, extremely rigorous and rigid concept. It's evangelism within Islam. So this kind of gives you an idea of the nature of the structure of Islam. So, but then they throw in something else. And this is the idea of abrogation or naskha. And what's important here is that when they take a look at the Quran... And remember, we had that pie chart with the Medinan and the Meccan chapters of the Quran. Well, the reason why this becomes important from a chronological perspective is because within Islamic law, within the whole concept of Islamic jurisprudence, as they're attempting to determine prioritization as they're attempting to determine order of prioritization, authority. You have to go to the last chapter that was revealed by Muhammad, to Muhammad from Gabriel, from Allah, and say, what does that say? What are the subject sets in that particular chapter? And whatever subject sets are in that chapter, that's the final word from Allah. And so if he said anything previous to that, it's subordinated in terms of authority to what was in that last revelation from Allah. So you have to work all the way backwards. And if there was a subject that was not addressed in the last chapter, but it was in the second to the last chapter, then that ruling or that revelation from Allah, it has the final authority. So now think about how that would work as you're thinking about trying to understand Islam. If you have to read it chronologically, you have to figure that out first. Then you have to know what was last and what subjects are in that chapter and what's therefore authoritative. And then you keep working backwards. And, oh, and by the way, you can't get your X-Acto knife out and cut out those sections that were spoken about in the last chapter that were spoken about previously in multiple other chapters and say, well, they're out of the question. We don't have to worry about that. No, because Allah did speak those things. So that is the word of Allah. And so Muslims are very, very cautious. Legal scholars are very, very cautious about how do they actually go through this process. And so these two quotations, Kamali, who has written The Principles of Islamic Jurisprudence, he's actually alive today. He is the legal scholar at the Islamic University of Malaysia. And Malaysia and Indonesia kind of go back and forth with each other from an Islamic perspective because that's a huge, huge, huge population, percentage of the population of Islam. And so they write Principles of Islamic Jurisprudence. He also has an introduction to Islamic jurisprudence, which would be Our Legal or Law 101. And so when you start the process of actually reading about this, you must know what's going on here. And so I'm going to read this last one because it's only partially there. The law was written down in a period of the Muhammad, peace be upon him. And you'll see that all the time. Gradually and in stages, okay, similar to our progressive revelation. They use that term as well. The aim was to bring a society steeped in immorality to observe the highest standards of morality as defined within Islam. This could not be done abruptly. It was done in stages, and doing so necessitated repeal or abrogation of certain laws. So that's where Muslims have in the early days of the Quran, in the early days of the revelation, they had these very, very gentle passages. There's no compulsion of religion within Islam. It's a very early statement, very early idea. But it's trumped later on in terms of what that really means. When we talk about this whole idea of consensus, that is to say, all the Muslim leaders, all the legal scholars, all the theologians, and there are some of those within Islam, come to decisions in a particular period of time. So consensus is this, is the agreement of all the mujtahids of the Muslims, that is the legal scholars and the theological scholars, at one particular period after the Prophet's death about a particular ruling regarding a matter of an event. You see how precisely this is written? So if a decision has been made, if it's been rendered, now where did it go? This is the first time I've used one of these, so you'll have to bear with me. So when the four necessary integrals of consensus exist, that is, the ruling agreed upon is an authoritative part of sacred law that is obligatory to obey and not lawful to disobey, nor can the mujtahads of a succeeding era make the thing an object of a new ijtihad because the ruling on it, verified by scholarly consensus, is an absolute legal ruling which does not admit to being contravened or annulled, all right? So, if the legal scholars in 1300 made decisions, all the legal scholars, can that be changed? No. It's next to impossible for that legal ruling to be changed. Right? So, when we're reading about Islam, and there's legal decisions, rulings that were made in 700 and 800, They remain in place today. Muslims do not change their law. There's no elasticity in Islamic law, right? They are very originalistic in terms of how they understand Islamic law, which is in something of a surprise to many of our legal scholars or legal schools, law schools in the United States today. They just seem to be able to just do whatever they want to do with the law as time goes on. So, contrary to our forefathers. So, when we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, okay, and you have a great resource center for us, the Muslim Brotherhood, up here in Plainfield, okay? And if you don't know what's up there, go take a look. It is the nature of Islam to dominate, not to be dominated, to impose its laws on all nations and to extend its power to the entire planet. So, is that a comprehensive decision? So what's the only law that's legitimate for the entire globe from an Islamic perspective? Islamic law, the Sharia. So should we be surprised when Muslims get together, vote together, and they immediately replace the existing law with the Sharia law as they did up in Hamrick, Michigan here not too long ago? In the United States, there are sections of the country which are absolutely ruled by Islamic law today. And you should be cautious and concerned when we have members of the U.S. Congress who are Muslims, because they can't swear allegiance to the Constitution. Otherwise, they're a hypocrite with reference to Islam. So as it relates to the U.S., the Ikhwan or the Brotherhood must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within, and sabotaging its miserable house, talking about the context of American ethos by their hands, and let the hands of believers, so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. Allah's religion is made victorious. They will use and abuse, and they will allow people to be used by Islam to accomplish their objectives. Whenever you see pastors, your pastor is an exemption here, who walk alongside of Muslims and say, we're one in the same. Muslims are just happy as a lark because they're getting credibility and credence from this is using their own, somebody else's hands to accomplish their purposes. Same thing with politicians, and I could go on and on with that. But this is what they're doing because they wanted to eliminate and destroy the Western civilization. They want to eliminate and destroy, right? Full replacement civilization. Anybody recognize anybody in that picture? Well, which one do you recognize? Okay, so why do you think this particular picture is important? The guy on the left is Hajjaj Amin al-Husseini, who happened to have been the senior Islamic cleric in Jerusalem. All right. Why do you think he was meeting with Hitler? Now, anybody recognize any of these guys? Huh? No. This is still World War II. This is still Germany. SS battalions. Guess which SS battalion was used to basically clean out what we know is today Serbia, Kosovo, etc., all that area. It was the Islamic SS battalion that they used, and they cleaned out all the Jews. And we had them in German uniforms. All right? So there was a direct correlation, there was a direct engagement between Hitler and the Muslims, right? Because he hated the Jews, and Islam hates the Jews. Common enemy. So this should cause you to have some degree of concern. It says the Islamic Institute of the International Institute of Islamic Thought in the U.S. government. Okay, the guys in the right they're all Muslim Brotherhood guys who are in this administration, right? The man on the left is the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, Jad Johnson. who is a Muslim. And if you were listening to Senator Cruz talk with him this last week, one of the statements that Johnson made is that my religion is being hijacked. He was lying through his eye teeth and he knew it, right? He's doing the work of Islam, and so he's in control of Homeland Security. That should cause you to have some degree of concern in terms of what's going on. So this just is an indication of where we're at. So now here we have, and the headline here was, who is Huma Abedin? A-B-E-D-I-N. So if you go out and you Google Huma, H-U-M-A, Abedin, you will see her picture come up with this other lady. That lady, Huma, has been Hillary's right-hand person since 1996 when she was her intern from Georgetown University. Her parents are senior members of the Saudi government. She grew up under the Islamic law according to Saudi Arabia. There is reason to question whether or not she is a spy for the Saudi government. And yet she's been walking along the side of Hillary Clinton. She was there with her the entire period of time that she was Secretary of State and before. She was there with her very early on. You remember Monica Lewinsky? Well, she was Hillary's equivalent during the Monica Lewinsky period as well. So this is all the Muslim Brotherhood. And you've noticed that recently she's not been in the news and she's not been showing up anywhere where Hillary has been. And that's very deliberate because a lot of us have come to the conclusion that we know who she is, and there's been some tracing that's going on from the intelligence community perspective, and as a consequence, there's a lot of concern of where Hillary is. Is she, or is she not, at least an Islamic sympathizer? So, this is just a cartoon. It says, no, I'd leave the jacket on for now, bro. And that's Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood. And remember, when you ask the question, how does a person become a Muslim? If your father's a Muslim, you are a Muslim if he's your father. It's that simple. Obama's father was a Muslim. Is he a Muslim? Has he ever repudiated Islam? No. Because of lying and deception, he's been able to go to a church and just make the appearances of this. So, just kind of where you are. So this is Islam. It's governed by jurisprudence, Sharia, not theology, and I'm going to have to move along here. So this is, I wish this was, okay, the United States, basically, it's we the people, the Constitution, then the three branches, and then all the religious entities, businesses, etc. Right? This is what it is in Islam. You have the Sharia, then they have the tri-version of the government as well, executive, judicial, and legislative in many other countries. Then here's the way the power flows. Men, women, and below that dotted line is all the kafirs, all of us. We don't have the same rights in Islam and in Islamic majority countries that the Muslims do. We are in a subordinated position, right? Now, this is just a couple of statements on jihad. The first one is from a lost text that was written in the 1300s. Jihad is also personally obligatory. And then the last one, which is an expansion of this, was written by the senior Islamic scholar in Sunni Islam in the 20th and 21st century. And he says, all the schools of Islamic jurisprudence, that's why I went through all that earlier, the Sunni, the Shia, and all the ancient and modern schools of jurisprudence agree, right? And then there's the whole discussion about this issue of jihad, and it's a military jihad. It's not this gentle jihad, this lesser and greater jihad discussion. That's just an absolute nonsense in terms of Islam, and Muslims know that. Now, this is a textbook that's used in the Islamic schools in the United States. It will be a fascinating read. I've read the whole thing, and I go, oh, my goodness. Right? So this is what's taught to the junior high school students here. All right? And this author is pretty solid in terms of what he does from being straightforward from an Islamic perspective, but this is one of the things that we find there. So for Muslims, Islam is not just a religion but a complete way of life governed by the Sharia law and comes from Allah, who alone is sovereign. Now, this is what's taught to the seventh graders who are going to Islamic schools in the United States. This is just one indication of what they're taught. And so they're indoctrinating their students quite well. So that's it. And I'm about 1 minute early. So I can take a couple of questions, and then I need to be running to pastor's office to get changed. So anybody have a question? Yes, sir. There are at least two representatives that I know of. One from Minnesota, one from Indiana. There's suspicion on several others. We haven't been able to pin down any of the senators yet, right? But that's the, in my opinion, the second tier. What's more important is people throughout the intelligence community, the FBI, and other places who have served overseas in Islamic countries who've come back Muslims, right? And those people have been elevated to positions of leadership. They're the ones that this is what Senator Cruz was so upset with Johnson, as he walked through all the documents that were written about terrorism subsequent to 9/11 and how they've purged systematically from the language, from the literature, anything that deals with Islam, extremism, violent extremism, jihad, anything. So it's basically, it's been, the only word I know to describe it is neutered in terms of its effectiveness, because they basically erased anything that might have any indication that any of this might have anything to do with Islam. So we've got a lot of people who are in the government at multiple levels who are declared Muslims, who attend the mosques, for example, the Falls Church Mosque and then the big one, the Adams Mosque there in D.C. One more question, and I'm going to just break. Anybody? Yes, sir. No. Why? Because it is first and foremost a legal system. It hides behind the First Amendment, and most Americans don't have the moral courage to say Islam is not a religion first. It's a legal system, it's a civilization, which with the intent to replace the U.S. Constitution with Islamic law. So therefore, the answer to that question, and these are U.S. lawyers who have walked through this, who have said, Islam absolutely does not derive protection from the First Amendment because of its true nature. Right? Now, pardon me for being so hard on that one, but we've got some pretty hard-headed people in Congress that just don't want to hear this. So I'm suggesting to you that you might want to talk to your congressmen and senators, both on the state and national level, and say, wait a minute, this is what Islam really is. Now, why don't you get busy with the job that you're supposed to be doing, which is protect the Constitution, which they all raised their hand and said, I will protect the Constitution. I don't think they're doing a really good job at that.